Hi, this is Ed Carpenter, and you need more front wings.
Hello and welcome to another More Front Wing podcast. I'm Steph Wallcraft, joined as always by Paul Dalby, and tonight in our third chair we are honored to be joined by Robin Miller. Robin, thanks so much for joining us tonight, and congrats on the new show. Everything seemed to go really well.
Well, they didn't fire me after the first show. That's always, you know, at my age, that's, you're always, it's always a 50-50 shot. That's the thing. I just say, you know, you're 61, you're not very handsome. We don't like you. See you. No, but what's cool is it's good that we've got, I wish we had a better time slot, but you know, you got to start somewhere. And, I think maybe after the hockey playoffs end, we might get a better re-air at night. Like if we could be at midnight on the East Coast and 9 o'clock on the West, that would be huge.
That would be huge, and but as you sort of started saying there, any time slot is better than the no time slot that we had a week ago.
Exactly.
So,
you guys are all kids. You know, I mean, there hasn't been any kind of, you know, there was a show back in the 90s, maybe in the early 90s, when CART was really in its heyday. I think Paul Page might have hosted it. But there's just not been anything, you know, and NASCAR's got all kinds of shows I mean, it's long overdue. And, you know, I think the key is that, it's, well, you know, it's a great place to have at the Pagoda, and you've got a lot of resources, a lot of teams in town, and it's not going to be just IndyCars. It's going to be USAC, Indy Lights, and try and maybe get some young faces on there. And I was telling Brian Clausen today, you know, he's got a lot of responsibility. If he can go out and do really good in this Freedom Race, which I think he will, I mean, it might open some of the owners or some of these idiot car owners to look at some of these USAC guys, not for the full season, but for at least maybe the Indy 500.
And the rest of the ovals, too, no doubt. It makes a lot of sense, and it's great for the young guns, especially, to have that platform.
Absolutely.
So, hey, I think, Robin, I think next week will be better when we don't have taxicabs running around behind you on the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
Yeah,
during
plan that. That was pretty bad timing.
Well, I mean, my God, of all things, your first open wheel show and there's a bunch of these toilets running behind you and making all that. Randy Bernard's like, good God, he goes, are they going to be out there long? I said, no, only 2 or 3 more hours. It's not hardly a distraction at all.
Well, we do want to talk about Brazil, but before we do, of course, today on the show, the news broke about the fact that the owners have unanimously minus one, that one being AJ, who decided to abstain, voted against bringing in the new aero kits in 2012. We're pretty sure that we're pretty solid on what your position is, Robin, but do you want to just make it perfectly clear for us?
Well, I said a long time ago, before you kids were born, there should be a bounty on car owners, and I have not changed my opinion. So, remember this. This is why it's hard to imagine they ever made it in the real world, because it is so unbelievable to think that they're going to say, well, these $70,000 aero kits, we can't afford the development, we can't afford the kits, and all that. Well, first of all, General Motors and Honda are going to develop the cars and the wind tunnel and everything. These guys aren't going to have any expense doing that. And if you can't afford $70,000 for an aero kit, maybe you shouldn't be in IndyCar racing. Mm-hmm. And most importantly, Marshall Pruitt of Speed started a poll today when we put my story up, because we put my story up right after we broke, you know, right after the Versa show. And we had over 3,000 people respond, and it's 94% of the fans saying, you stick with spec racing, we'll go watch croquet. We're not watching this anymore. And at this, you know, and I told Randy, you know, I've talked to Randy 30 times today, and we were just talking about, Mike Hall wrote a really, really impassioned, really good letter that hopefully we're going to try and maybe post on Speed here in a couple of days. But it's just this common sense thing, looking at this whole thing and saying, you know, we're making a big mistake here, boys, because we have a chance to have a new engine. We have a chance to have some different looking cars, and our fans have been telling us all this time, listen, we don't like spec racing. We're sick of everybody having the same car. So, you know, I mean, it's just unbelievable to think that the owners all agreed to this a few months ago, and now they're all like, well, you know, we really can't afford it, and it's mind-blowing. And I told Randy, I warned him, first time I met Randy, I warned him, and, it's just unbelievable.
Robin, is there dissension within Target Chip Ganassi Racing? Because you're saying Mike Hull passionately spoke in favor of the kits, and yet it appears that Chip Ganassi didn't vote in favor of them?
Well, Chip wasn't there, and Mike just kind of went along with everybody else, but then he got up and made a speech to the owners.
Oh, okay. It seems a little bit as though they're living in a vacuum, don't you think? I mean, 94% popularity in favor of the Aero kits. How can they sit there and vote against it? It's like they're not seeing the big picture at all. Do they? I mean, if they're going to talk about the difference to their bottom line, they have to realize that $75,000 now is going to pay back in spades in making the fans happy, and it's going to lose them in those tickets not being bought when people walk away because they're just so frustrated with the situation.
Absolutely.
I think they've really hit their breaking point with people's tolerance for spec racing in general and these cars specifically. And it just, if I'm being perfectly frank, it blows my mind that they don't see that after all the big deal that's been made for the last few months about putting the committee together, getting the decision made, telling people what it was going to be. It's just unreal to think that they would turn around and say to fans, oh, we're going to put this off, and that they would think that that would be okay.
Well, and it just shows you that this mentality, this me mentality, which is why CART finally, you know, fell to pieces, it just shows you that they don't really get it, and they don't really care. I think my whole life, I've been covering this stuff for 43 years, and I've been watching for 50, and you just kind of go, you know, you finally have somebody that's in charge of this series that has a brain and has a marketing background and has a really people skill set to try and, you know, get things done. He works his butt off. And I told Randy the first night, I said, you know, I know you're used to dealing with bulls, but I said, you're going to be dealing with a collection of two-faced scumbags like you've never met in your life. And they will say and do anything they want to do, and they'll turn on you, they'll turn on each other, they're not all like that, but most of them are. And it's pathetic. It's really, really sad to think that, you know, that they're a necessary evil. You got to have them, I guess, unless the Speedway would just buy all the cars someday and say, we're going to buy 40 cars and we're going to maintain them and we're going to give them the drivers we think that are qualified. Maybe that's the answer.
Well, maybe.
Robin, how much of this dilemma that we're in today is a consequence of a lot of the owners being reliant on ride buyers who are bringing in just enough money to help them get through this year but not grow their team to the point? I mean, you look at, let's look at KV, who spent an ungodly sum of money repairing cars last year, never really could get the R&D to develop their own to further the progress of their own team. And now these cars that, you know, these cars were supposed to expire after the 2005 season. After the merger in 2008, they thought, okay, we just have to get through 2010 probably. 2011, we'll bring out a new car. Well, then we got to 2009, well, 11's not going to work, so now we're going to wait till 12. Because everyone keeps wanting to say, I can't afford it this year, I can't afford it next year, I can't afford it the year after that.
Can they ever afford it?
Yeah, when are they ever going to be able to afford this car?
You know, it's just, I think the thing that's interesting is that Randy's the first guy that's really come along and listened to the fans. And he's home right now answering his 740 emails he's gotten today. And, you know, he's out there and he answers them all and he talks and he stops and talks to people and he genuinely understands look, if you don't please the people that are either going to watch the thing in person or on TV, then why bother? And he understands that there's been a bunch of people that deserted this thing after the split, and they've never come back. So how do you get them back? Well, this is a way to try and entice them back. But it's the absolute worst thing is to throw something out there that says, you know,
the politics haven't changed.
We've decided again that we really don't care that what we said 6 months ago, and we really don't care that we've kind of stomped on tradition, and we really don't care what the fans think. We're going to do what we want to do.
Right. So now the poker game starts. In your opinion, do you think that Randy is a strong enough personality that he can put his foot down and face every single one of these owners and tell them that they're doing the wrong thing and legislate it? And if he does, how are the owners going to react to that?
Well, it's kind of like, I mean, I was talking to Mike Hall a couple times today, and he was like, you know, we're this isn't Kark. The owners don't make the decision. It's up to Randy and Kottman. If they decide that there's – I think here's what they could do, and I think this is, I think it's kind of been out there anyway. We just kind of take it for granted. I think the thing's always been optional. It was optional if Honda and General Motors and Lotus wanted to build an aero kit. It was up to them. But it was optional. It wasn't mandatory. And I guess it's not mandatory that you buy it. You know, you could just take the Dallara and just run theirs because it's going to be made into the tub anyway. It's probably going to be a good package. So it's not, but the most important thing to remember is that if Chevrolet, if Honda has gone to the, if they spent a couple months developing a car already with Nick Wirth, which I think they have, and they want to run, if they want to have their own body kit to go with their own engine, they should damn well be allowed to do it. And if Roger Penske wants to stay, if he wants to stay with Dallara to run a Chevrolet, fine, he can do that too. But it should not be this witch hunt that says, no, nah, we changed our mind, we don't want to do this, we want to postpone it here. Nah. Yeah, and I think Randy, I think, you know, well, he said in that story I wrote, he goes, I think they're making a mistake.
Mm-hmm. Do you know why AJ abstained from the vote, Robin?
Oh, I called him in the shop today, and I just said, okay, what's your take? He goes, well, my take is, you know, it's, if Ganassi and Penske are against it, I'm for it. If they're for it, I'm against it. he didn't really say that. I'm just kidding. But he kind of thinks that way sometimes. And I think he just said, you know, I want to know more about what's going on. But he goes, you know, new cars are going to be, you know, we're going to have to pony up money for cars and engines. But, you know, the engine's going to go from $1.2 million to $695,000 for a lease. And the cars are going to go from $650,000 to $350,000, and if you're in, you live, have a car, you know, you shop in Indianapolis, you get another $100,000 or $150,000 knocked off of it for your first car. So, you know, I mean, it's gonna, the tire bill is gonna sadly go up. But you know,
that's
what
I was gonna ask you, Robin. Do you know how much the tire bill's going up?
Oh, it's going up a lot. It's probably gonna double. It'll probably be close to $550,000, I imagine.
Right.
But
that's not ideal. But it does get made up.
It's. And Firestone kind of had them by the short hairs. There's not much you can do without tires. We can do without owners, commentators, new engines, and chassis, but tires are fairly important.
Yes, yes. And it's definitely worth their money, and it's good that they recognize that to stay with a reliable tire maker that's given them a quality product for such a long period
right.
of time, especially coming into the new car and all that. So,
right.
Anybody else want to touch on anything with the aero kits before we move on?
Well, I think just before we go, I think this is what Robin said. It shouldn't be a mandate. Nobody has ever said that you have to, that the Dallara stock kit wasn't going to be available. So from that standpoint, I guess I still don't understand where the belly aching is coming from. And to be quite honest, I've heard the argument that, okay, we'll all run those, but then, you know, if Penske decides he's going to run the Honda one and all of a sudden he starts winning, well, then we're all going to have to go get the Honda one. Well, Robin, like you said, you've been around a long time before Steph and I came around, and long before you were around, people were already saying, you know, speed is money, how fast do you want to go? So it's just
right.
The same thing. It's not a new thing, and it's just the same thing generation after generation after generation, and it just seems this is the latest iteration of it, and, you know, I hope that if the money is the concern here, then there's no reason that anyone should be feel like they're forced to buy an alternative kit, that this Dallara kit, which I guess one thing I haven't heard explained is we keep hearing the $70,000 figure bounced around here, but do we know really what that even includes? Does this mean every time EJ Viso knocks the wall down, they have to buy a new $70,000 kit, or, you know, are these plate? Is it $70,000 for what you might consider maybe a license, and then, you know, substantially cheaper to replace the individual parts? Do we know that
yet? I don't know that yet. I think that's one of the things that Tony's trying to nail down. There was talk that maybe the replacement package would be $35,000. The thing is that General Motors or Honda or Lotus, whoever builds them, is going to lose it. You know, they're going to spend millions of dollars developing them and refining them. So it's a loser as far as who's going to make them. So to hear the car owners bellyache about how much money it's going to cost in R&D, well, they're not going to spend any money in R&D. These bodywork kits are going to be ready and tested when they go on their car. But, you know, it's like, guys talking to Greg Beck earlier. I mean, he's like, look, I'm a little guy. I don't even have a car yet. But he goes, I want to have the option to go different. I want to be different. The only way we have a chance is if I hit on something that somebody else doesn't have, and maybe we get hooked up with the right driver. I mean, or the right engineer. So I guess the thing that bothers me is that I can see, I mean, Roger Penske, of all people, we played phone tag today, so he left me a couple of messages. But what I want to say is, Roger, you represent what Indy used to be about. You had your own cars and your own engines, and you took the rule book and clubbed everybody over the head with it in 1994, and you know what Indy's tradition was built on. That's what got you involved in this. You wanted to be different. You wanted to have Penske cars, and that's what was cool about it. This smacks against your stance on this makes no sense whatsoever. And here's the other thing that makes no sense. When Randy Bernard went to General Motors in June with Jules DeFerrin as part of the iconic committee, he called me after the meeting. He said, my God, he goes, not only are they interested, he goes, they're more excited about having their own car than they are having their own engine. So what's changed their mind in the last 6 months or so? You know, that's what I want to know. What has changed their mind about wanting to have a car? Because Honda's not ever changed their mind. They want to have one.
Well, and the other thing that I haven't heard anybody mention about this yet is, can you imagine the standpoint of the manufacturers who are sitting there ready to spend their R&D money on developing these kits, and to hear the owners say, oh, no, you know, we said we were going to do it, now we're not going to do it, we might change our mind next week, we're not sure. What kind of an impression does that make on these people who have committed to making this equipment?
Good question. That's just another reason they're probably scratching their heads going, now we're getting back in this for what reason?
Let's take that a bit further, because what could this potentially mean for Randy Bernard's credibility, where, you know, okay, we're going to do the kits, we're not going to do the kits, we're going to do double file restarts, we're not going to do them, we are going to do them, we're going to do them on some courses, okay, we're going to do them on all courses, you know, we're going to use a lucky dog, no, we're not going to use a lucky dog. Is his credibility starting to be questioned at this point yet, if he goes back on these aero kits?
I wouldn't think so, because he's not really going back on them. You can't make the car owners buy a kit, and I guess you can't make General Motors or Lotus build a kit. But you certainly can give people the option to have it. I mean, if 75% of the people end up with Dallara tubs and Dallara bodywork with their engine, well, you know, it probably won't be the end of the world, but there ought to be, if Honda wants to build 10 for their 10 customers, then they should be allowed to do that. And I think, you know, Randy's still learning the sport. He's basically just trying to gauge the landscape and say, okay, the restart idea was Ganassi and Penske, because they got cars in NASCAR. We got to do something to spice things up. So after the first race, all the drivers wanted to get rid of it. Well, he stuck by it and said, no, we're not going to get rid of it. We're not going to have a knee-jerk reaction. We're going to see how it works. Well, thankfully, he stuck with it, and it's been pretty damn exciting the last three races. So it's just like this. But the difference here is that this is such a major change, and they have a little bit of, you know, they've got a little bit of positive momentum that they're going to have new cars and new engines finally, and they've got General Motors back, and this is going to be pretty cool, and maybe IndyCar's making a little bit of a comeback. And this goes against everything that stands for, and it pisses off 93% of the people that like this stuff. I mean, I just got a update from the speed poll, 3,122 votes, 92.2% want kits in 2012. 166 are okay with the delay.
Yeah, that's pretty clear. Well, I guess all we can do on that is wait and see what happens, but I think the message is loud and clear, so we'll see how that plays out. Let's talk about Brazil. We can start by talking about the events on Sunday. Should that green flag have ever been flown in the first place?
Yeah, I think you have to when you get that many people there, and you've got to try, and it's up to the, you know, you got to give the drivers, they have to have a little bit of a say, and they let them go out, and, you know, when they came in, they, you know, it was pretty obvious. They were like, hey, we can't see on the back stretch. So, you know, I mean, I remember being in Australia when they threw the green flag, and it was a monsoon, and they had Jimmy Vassar was upside down, and Fernandez broke his leg, and I've never seen so many cars piled up, and then they ran about 10 more laps behind the pace car and declared Mario Dominguez the winner. And, you know, that was terrible. That was a horrible day for IndyCar racing, and last week was just one of those deals. If they could have just had Monday's weather on Sunday, it was perfect, because that's exactly the kind of amount of rain you need. Mm-hmm. You can deal with it. It was just fine. The other thing is, people just have to understand, I bet you if there was competition, Firestone could build a badass rain tire. They could have an intermediate, and they could have a super soft, just like they do in Formula One. But they've got kind of a hard rain tire. It's not that good. I bet you if they had to build some, go back and you know, I mean, you don't have that many rain races, and there's no competition, so it's money they probably, it's really probably hard to justify. But if you had some really good, soft, deep-grooved rain tires, you might be surprised what the visibility and the handling was like then. I think it would be probably easy, because I think everybody did a pretty nice job on Monday, and those conditions were pretty tricky.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring that up, because the prevailing opinion on social media anyway appeared to be, I thought we raced in the rain, why can't we pull this off? And the tires playing a big part of that is an interesting way of looking at it. Might this be some motivation for Firestone to see if they can't do something with that, or do you think that it'll just be let go?
Well, I don't know. I'm gonna send Al Spire an email here in a little while and just say, hey, just thinking out loud, but I just wondered, you know, if there's any chance that maybe you guys could look at the rain tire and decide, hey, you know, we can probably do something much better and give everybody a little bit better chance. I think that's probably what, you know, some people that I've talked to that have called said, you know, Formula One runs in the rain, well, why can't IndyCar? Well, it's so much easier if there's a monsoon to run on a road course with changes in elevation. The problem with street circuits is you got all that standing water, and you don't have that at a road course. The only place I've ever seen water really stand at a road course was Elkhart Lake, when Kart started a race once with a small river going across the track in front of turn 6 or 7, and Guzman went almost got upside down, and there were guys flying through the air, and so they finally red flagged it. But most of the time, even if it's a really hard rain on a road course, the water dissipates enough off the side of between the cars running over it and the fact that it, you know, runs off the side of the track, that you can deal with it a little bit better. But when it's, you know, when you're in a little concrete canyon like that, it's awful tough.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was one other thing on Sunday that's worth touching on, and that was the contact that was right off the start. I think that people were willing to let Elio go on that until Dario said in his interview after things were red flagged on Sunday that he thought that Elio had come a little bit too far up alongside and that he may have been responsible for that contact. What was your take on that? Did you see it the way that Dario did? Do you think Elio got away with one there because nobody was really paying attention?
Well, Wally Dallenbach and Bekus and Bob Jenkins and I were all sitting at IMS Productions calling a race, and Wally Dallenbach and Bekus, they had the same reaction. We all went, where's he going? Where are you going right there? You're running out of racetrack. You got nowhere to go. And it's the first lap, and if anybody was probably on a tiptoe through the first lap, it would have been him.
Yeah, no kidding.
So I just think, you know, I think he's pressing, and I think Will's destroying him. And Briscoe's kicking his butt too. So, I mean, I think there's, you know, I mean, he'll probably come here and win the race because he is one lucky guy, and he's very good. No, he's really good here. There's no doubt about it. This is his place. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, Dario kind of fishtailed a little bit and got into him, of course. But, I mean, when it's pouring down rain like that, you want to kind of throw through the first lap, and especially that little stretch of S is there when it's so narrow and so treacherous. It's just like, I just didn't know where he was. You know, you just wanted to kind of, where is this guy going?
Yeah. So Monday morning, they restarted the race to, unfortunately, empty grandstands, but there's nothing you can really do about that.
No.
There was some word that they were going to let people in for free and then didn't. I guess that would have been on the promoter's side that decision was made. I'm not sure why that played out the way it did. Because last year when St. Pete got rained out on the Monday, they had free admission, and it was actually a pretty decent crowd. So it's a shame that they couldn't get some new fans a little bit of exposure by opening the gates on Monday morning. But, you know, such is the way that it is. But,
that's what's tough. Those people, it's a very poor country, and those people probably saved their money to buy those tickets, and that was going to be a big event for them.
Yeah, it's sad to see them lose out on that aspect of it for sure. But getting down to the racing, I know that it started raining right as the green flag fell, but it still seemed as though the track was awfully wet still to start everybody on slicks, didn't it?
No, because it didn't start until they were halfway around the first lap. It was unbelievable that it just started. I was talking to Will tonight, and he's like, God, he goes, you know, we got about to turn five or six, and all of a sudden it starts raining. I'm like, well. So they all obviously came roaring in.
Yeah. One thing that did go well on Monday was the restarts. They looked a lot better than they had at Long Beach. And, of course, obviously the problem at Long Beach was just people could not get around that hairpin double file in order to and have enough space on the front stretch to get lined up before the start-finish line. It was obvious that there was enough room in the hairpin at Brazil to do that. But one thing that I had considered, and I'd like to have your thoughts on this, Robin, was the fact that the guys might have been behaving a bit more on the restarts just because with the wet conditions, it seemed as though maybe the tires were going to stay a little bit cleaner, and that was something that people mentioned as being a big problem at Long Beach, was that they were picking up a lot of debris trying to go wider on the restarts. Do you think that that is a reasonable, or do you think that they just decided to behave themselves or were incited to behave themselves this week?
Yeah, I think definitely the conditions and the fact that maybe they all decided, you know, we're supposed to be really good at this. Let's try. I mean, the restarts were fabulous, and they were exciting. I mean, come on, Sato made what a great outside pass he made. I mean, that was one of the highlights of the race.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, maybe hopefully they got tired of people hearing them say they can't even drive down the straightaway on a restart. And not only could they not drive down the straightaway on a restart on dry conditions at Long Beach and St. Pete, here they are in this nasty condition, and they do a hell of a job.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if you've heard about this yet, Robin, but speaking of the restarts, Mario Andretti mentioned last night on Twitter that he was of the opinion that on road and street courses with wet conditions that the restarts should be run single file. Do you think that that's necessary?
Well, they were. If the rain's really, really heavy, maybe. Tony Kottman said, you know, that might not be a bad idea if it's just real. But as the track was dry and it was just kind of a drizzle there, I mean, that's what people want to see, and I tell you, they came around the last turn. They came down that long straightaway, lined up in 8, 9, or 10 rows, 2 by 2. That's what people want to see.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I mean, I just thought, you know what? It's a wide enough place too that they could go down the straightaway. Now, are there a place like Toronto? Would it be better to have single file restarts? Maybe, because it's so narrow. You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean. Yeah, I guess you just don't want to do anything. It's just that, look at the things that can happen. Look at how Kanaan's done coming. You know, he was bitching after. I said, what are you bitching about? I said, if it wasn't for that, you'd have finished 15th. I said, this is made for Tony Kanaan. This
yeah.
is exactly what you want.
Yeah.
And he goes, yeah, it's played in my hands pretty well. But, I mean, race drivers are going to be, they love to bitch just like fans do. You know, give them a chance to bitch and they're going to bitch. So,
that's sort of the sort of people that this sport attracts, isn't it?
Shut up and drive. That was a T-shirt they put out a few years ago.
That's right.
Yeah.
They're a perfect match for the owners, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Now, here's a question for you. Why on earth did Jimmy Vassar not decide to put Vizo and Sato on different pit strategies when he had the
opportunity? That's what we kept talking about. Well, Dombeck and I were talking about that during the break. I go, now, if you got two cars and you're running first and third or first and second, aren't you going to probably put one of them with everybody else and then maybe try something different?
Yeah.
I think possibly my reason would be Vassar was in such shock that both cars were still running with four wheels. He probably seized up. He couldn't think fast enough.
Well, while we're talking about EJ Bezos, since I'm sure that's who you're alluding to in your comment there, we don't want to go over this topic again because this really just touches on the whole debacle from Edmonton last year. But Bezos' black flag, anything to add to that other than the comments about whether the blocking rule is appropriate in the first place?
I've never thought Brian Barnhart should be in charge of race control. The guy was a parts changer and a truck driver, and that's fine, but he never driven a race car. He has no, and he was given way too much power by Tony George. So, I guess my whole situation with him is that, you know what? They've got this rule now where they've got an invisible line down the middle of the straightaway or something. You got to stay on it. To think that Castro Neves was leading a race, and it was a right-hand turn, and he was not allowed to protect it. I talked to, you know, it doesn't matter if it was Tommy Kendall or Tom Gloy or Dan Gurney or people are like, what? Who made this rule? Now, Frank Keating and I argued about this, like, for three nights on the phone. He goes, you're wrong, though. I said, no, you're wrong. This is not the way racing was meant to be, son. This is insane. I don't like blocking any more than you do, and I blame blocking on the Brazilians. We never had blocking in IndyCar racing before the Brazilians came over here, and we didn't. That's the way, that's a fact. But, no, you're leading the race, and you're not going to be able to protect the inside line going into a right-hand corner? Are you nuts? It's just insanity.
Yeah, now Barnhart says that part of the justification for that is the spec cars. Two-parter here. Do you think that that's the case, and do you think that it'll change after the cars are not spec anymore?
No, I think he needs to go. It's what he needs to go. He needs to go away, and I don't want to hear him talk about no. Do you guys understand that he had some no passing zones set up at a couple? That he's had a map with some no passing zones on it.
We saw the notes race from Long Beach.
No passing zones in an IndyCar race.
When we spoke to Brian,
how would that have worked at what he had just told Zanardi after he passed Herta in the course crew in one of those famous passes of all time? Well, I'm going to have to take that away from him. That was a no passing zone. It just makes me crazy. It makes me crazy to think this guy is in charge of auto races and he tries to micromanage him. He tries to make start single file. He tells guys where they can pass. He tells guys, you're running too close to each other in practice. I mean, you people have no idea what this guy used to do on the radio when he could talk to all the drivers at Texas and he'd be screaming at him, you're running too close. You're running too close to each other. Really?
Okay, Robin. So then, if not to doubt you, I'm sure that everything that you've said is absolutely true. Why do the drivers put up with it?
Well, I mean, they really don't have a lot of choice, but a lot of them have been saying lately, God, I wish we could get Tony Kottman. I wish he could be the chief steward, but Kottman don't want to do it. He's busy with rules and stuff. And it's a tough, look, it is a tough job. It's not an easy thing to do, but all really anybody wants is just some consistency. And when you tell me that Paul Tracy spun somebody out because he tried to do it, and you tell me Dario Franchitti, Castro Neves spun Justin Wilson out for fifth place, but he didn't mean to, now Brian Barnhart's going to interpret what the drivers are thinking. I mean, this is so insane. I have lunch every Friday with Johnny Parsons, Lee Koonsman, Bill Lukovich, Gary Bettenhausen, Jerry Sneva, Steve Chaffee, Bubby Jones, guys that raced in the 60s and 70s were all badass race drivers. So one day at lunch I said, boys, who was the chief steward when you guys were racing? And they said, well, Harlan Fangler. I said, no, He was the chief steward at the Indy 500. I know that. Who was the chief steward at all the USAC races, all the Champ Car races? I don't know. They looked at each other for three. Nobody had any idea. Well, his name was Art Myers. But the reason you didn't know was because no one ever, he was never seen or heard, because most of the on-track, if you had a problem with somebody, either you settle it with your fists or you told them next time, you know, next time you better be prepared to get spun out, because I'm taking you out. And they police themselves. I'm not saying that it's not bad to have somebody that's going to police the drivers, but not at your every breath and not every time. I mean, I saw Viso move over to get some water once on a straightaway because, you know, there was some dry patches, and I didn't see him make any swerve moves. Maybe, you know, we were at the mercy of the Brazilian camera crew, so we didn't get to see everything probably, but it's just, don't over-officiate auto races. Let these guys race. And I just think the drivers have lost all respect, but most of the drivers have lost all respect for Barnhart because they don't think he's consistent. And they do think he plays favorites. And they're a little perturbed with single-file restarts at Indy and no passing zones. And, you know, I could go on and on. But
You've been very vocal about being a big fan of Randy Barnhart, and you've had his ear quite a bit, but he's taken a stand on the fact that he's not interested in letting Brian Barnhart go. Have you had any discussions with him about that?
Now, that's funny. After about the 10th time we went out to lunch or dinner, he said, listen, do me a favor. You got to go 45 minutes without bad-mouthing Barnhart. You got to have a 45-minute, there's got to be at least a 45-minute period where you're not allowed to talk about him. So I just quit talking about him after a while because I can only say so much.
Well, Robin, you mentioned the no passing zone. Let me specifically, we're talking about the hairpin turn 11 at Long Beach. When we spoke with Brian last week, he said that the impetus behind the no passing edict there actually came from the drivers, and this wasn't something that was new this year. It's something that the drivers had asked for over the last several years.
In fact, he said that he wanted he had drivers wanting to hang a standing yellow in that turn.
Well, they ran Long Beach for 35 years before the IRL got involved, and no one ever said that to my knowledge. And, you know, I talk to drivers most of the time. All I'd say is if some drivers actually felt like there should be a no-passing zone, they probably ought to find something else to do.
Well,
I don't want to see guys like that racing. Sorry.
Fair enough.
One other thing, you talked about the blocking rule, and obviously we know your opinion of it. I guess, let me ask you, is the current blocking rule, as you understand it in IndyCar today, is it different than the white stripe that Tony Kottman put down the middle of the road in Toronto and San Jose a couple of years ago?
That might have been where it started, but the best rule, Wally and I were talking when his dad was chief steward of CART, the best, if you're going to have a rule about blocking, which you probably have to because we have a lot of Brazilians in the series, you have to say, okay, in the old days in CART, you were entitled to one move. You could make one move to defend your position. Because Mario and I talked about this once, and Mario said, absolutely, you should definitely be allowed to protect your position.
Well, that's the rule in F1 as well, isn't it?
Oh, I don't know. God, unless you're Michael Schumacher.
Well,
he can pretty much do whatever he wants.
Yeah.
The one thing I remember, and this was before the whole blocking thing even came up at Edmonton, I was actually playing golf last year in May with one of the Indy Lights drivers, or one of the Indy Lights owners, and we got talking about the issue of blocking and the difference in governing style, if you will, between Brian and Tony. And he told me at the time, he said, let me tell you what the difference is between them. Traditionally, Brian has always allowed you to make that one move, and once you make your move, you're set in the way you are. And again, this was back in last May, and he said Tony has always gone with the idea that you race your racing line, and any time you deviate from that line, you deviate from that line to keep somebody else behind you, whether you move first or you move second or you move three times. As soon as you move off of that preferred racing line, then you're blocking, in my opinion. And sure enough, that's what the interpretation was when we got to Edmonton 3 or 4 months later. So to me, it wasn't a surprise to hear that rule was in effect if Kottman had been part of race control given what I had heard from at least one owner previously about the reputation that those two gentlemen had in their different styles of officiating.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that you just, I don't know. I mean, I know I'm old, and I know that I have trouble sometimes with change, but I just, we never had to have this. This wasn't necessary before, and you get all caught up in who should be penalized and who gets to drive through, and let's ruin this guy's race, and this guy, you know, I mean, I guess that because they are, the cars are so close that maybe you have to police them a little stricter than you, I mean, say everybody's got the same thing, maybe that's an excuse. I'm not sure I buy it, but I just think that there's something, the essence of racing is taking a chance. I'm going to try this guy on the outside. I'm going to do this. Look at Sato's pass the other day in the rain. That was spectacular. You know, that was really cool. That's what people, I think, like racing for. I don't think they want to see, I mean, Vito's penalty. I mean, just telling me he has to give the spot. If he's blocked Marco, then let Marco go around him. I mean, I just think it's a way. He drove a good race for the first time all year and was doing a hell of a job, and it's, the penalty doesn't fit the crime. I mean, Castroneves took 10 people out in 3 races, and he really didn't get punished. You know, Barnhart says, we had a conference call in the other day, the Versus staff didn't. And I said, Brian, I said, Elio's ruined all kinds of guys' races already. And I said, your defense is, well, he went to the back. Well, that's not enough. It's not enough just to stay in the back. He was already at the back. He ran into his teammate. And he said, well, if you're saying, should we hand out a more stringent penalty or a different penalty, that's a completely different matter. Maybe we'll look at that. But I don't think it's a completely different matter. It's all part of judging what's the crime and what should the fair penalty be for it. I just hate the fact that we spend so much time talking about penalties and drive-throughs and who did this on purpose and who had the intent to do that. When you have a guy like Justin Wilson who never bitches about anything, say, just tell me what the rules are and be consistent. That's really all you need to know. When somebody that's as fair as he is says something like that, that pretty much tells me what I need to know. Let me know when I'm allowed to knock somebody out of the way and it's just racing, or when I'm not allowed or just let me know what that is, because right now I don't know.
Well, Robin, I think we've, not only tonight, but I think over the last couple of weeks, we've kind of beat the rule enforcement and consistency to death. Let me challenge you though now. Can you tell us one good thing that you like about Brian Barnhart? There's gotta be one.
You're ruining Robin's night, you know that, right?
It's late, he'll be going to bed anyway.
Can't think of any. Sorry.
There you go, Paul. You got your answer. Okay, one more question for you, Robin. We're gonna turn ahead to Indy now. Pick 3 drivers who are not gonna make the field.
3 drivers that are not gonna make the field.
Yeah.
Boy, I don't know. I mean, I would think Ho Chi Minh Ren Tin Tin, whatever that guy's name is, he's probably not gonna make it. Since this is gonna be his first oval race, but you know, Milk and Donuts made it, but this one didn't have any competition. This is going to be a really good, this is going to be the first time since the split where there's probably going to be 42 damn good drivers going for 33 spots. I think it's hard to say. I don't really see any wankers in this field. I really don't. I mean, I don't know about James Jakes. Him and Ren Tin Tin might not make it. And who's the other? I'm just trying to think of who else might, struggle. But, you know, if you got a good oval track program, I think Paul Tracy missed the race last year, for God's sakes. I mean, so anything's possible. That's why you just can't, I would, those are the only two I could pick that look like they would be early candidates to probably, you know, not make it, but lots of crazy things can happen. I'm just really happy Buddy Rice has a ride, and Schechter has a ride, and Townsend Bell did a good job, and he's got a ride, and Bruno's got a ride. Look at all the one-offs. There's a lot of really good drivers that are just running the Indy 500. Weldon, I mean, it's going to be fun to watch qualifying again.
Absolutely.
Robert, are you a little bit surprised, though, that we haven't seen some of the more traditional one-off owners come back this year, given the inventory? You know, we got Greg Beck, who's partnered up with Brian Herta, but I was hoping we would see, you know, the Paul Dyatloviches, maybe the Ron Himmelgarns, some of those types come back. Are you surprised we haven't heard from any of them?
Well, no, I think, I think when you get out of it, it's probably hard to get back in. I was talking to John Menard a few weeks ago. I said, Menard, why don't you enter some cars in the Indy 500? You could do it pretty cheap. And he's like, he goes, I still like racing, but I like IndyCar racing, but he goes, I'm watching my kid every weekend in NASCAR. I just don't have time. I mean, there's a guy that's a four-time billionaire. The money wouldn't be any big deal. It's just, I guess it's the interest in doing it. And, can I be competitive? And, it's going to be tough for teams just to show up. It's tough just to show up anymore and be competitive, but that's what will be interesting because I'm sure that, Herta and Weldon, that's going to be a good combination. I hope Tracy, I think Brian Reinbold will give him a good oval track car. I think he'll be all right. But, Schechter, Buddy Rice is going to be with Panther. They've always had good cars in Indy. So it's possible that maybe some of these guys, it's obviously going to be awful hard to beat Penske or Ganassi, but I don't know. I like the fact that it's going to really mean something to make this race again.
One more question for you.
No, you said that was the last one.
I know,
lied.
I did lie, and I've done this a couple times, and everybody's called me out on it. thoughts on Trump as the pace car driver?
Well, it's embarrassing, I think, just because, this is the 100-year anniversary. What AJ or Parnelli or, I don't know. It's just, it's everybody's bad mouth in the speedway, and It's not their call. It's Izod's call. I'm pretty sure Izod made the decision because I think there's a couple of people high up in Izod that are buddies with Trump, and I think that's we're stuck with him. But maybe there's a Dump Trump website, and I guess it's lit up like our speed poll is tonight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a Facebook page, I think. That's
that's
going crazy over it.
I got all kinds of people saying, "Hey, you got to see, check out this page." I'm like, "All right."
How's the Facebook thing going for you?
That's another question, Steph.
I know.
See, Steph, it's somebody filled out a Facebook page for me a few months ago and said, "Hey, Miller, when did you get on Facebook?" I said, "I'm not on Facebook." And they said, "Yeah, you got a page and your picture's on it and there's information about you." I said, "Well," so I called up the Facebook guy and said, "Hey, can somebody start a page about somebody else?" He goes, "Well, sure, it happens all the time." I said, "But I didn't ask for it." And he goes, "Well, do you want to take it down?" I said, "Well, they went to all that trouble. I guess I'll leave it up." But I'm glad I did because I connected with a bunch of guys all over California, Ohio, Wisconsin. I used to race midgets with. I haven't talked to in 30 years. And so that's been kind of cool. And it is, I'll have to say, grudgingly, it's a pretty swell way to get the word out. Like, watch Wind Tunnel this Sunday night. We're going to have this guest. Or watch the Versa show on Tuesday at 4 p.m. And, I'll say this. There must be a lot of people online a lot of times during the day because it's amazing how much response you get.
Yeah.
Well, we're looking forward to when you join Twitter now, too.
Not a chance.
But you can curse on there, though. Wasn't that?
Not a chance.
We
nope.
Even got Dario.
Yeah, if Dario's
okay,
on there.
Yeah, I know. Kanaan's got like 300,000. Kanaan's got like, his is out of control, all the people he's got.
Mm-hmm.
But, I wish we had typewriters and, but we don't anymore. Those things happen. So you just have to try and, I'm going to grudgingly move into the 21st century, I guess.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Robin. Your insight.
All right. Good talking to you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Rob.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Take care. And coming up next, Paul and I spent some time this afternoon speaking with Dan Weldon. Unfortunately, we spoke with Dan before the news broke about the aero kit, so we didn't get a chance to get his opinion on that. But we did get to speak to him about his plans for the month of May and for the rest of the 2011 season. Dan, thanks for joining us. Great to hear about you landing this ride with Brian Herta Autosport for the Indianapolis 500. Can you tell us a little bit about how that deal came about?
Yeah, it was funny, really. I was blessed to receive a lot of interest for the Indianapolis 500, and I hadn't really spoken to Brian too much about the Indianapolis 500 itself or his situation with the team. And I actually called him. We've been friends ever since we've been teammates, and he's somebody that I respect immensely. And obviously, having known Brian for a while now, I know what an astute business person he is too. So he did mention that you know he would like to have the ability to be able to run me, but I don't think he had the budget quite at that time to be able to do it. And then after a few phone calls that he made, he actually came back and said, listen, would you be willing to do this if I can get this stuff confirmed? And I said, yeah, because I know how you're going to do it. I know the people that you're going to get involved with. And, you know, it's certainly, Brian is certainly somebody that has, you know, like a lot of passion for the Indy 500. And I think as a driver, he knows exactly what it takes. And, you know, when he started putting the program together, it was really a no-brainer. It's probably the quickest deal I've ever put together, and certainly the cheapest in lawyer's fees, just because I think we both have the same goal.
When you look at the team that Brian's put together for you and the package that you're walking into, what realistically do you think that you do have a shot at getting a win out of this?
Yeah, absolutely. There's no reason that we can't. I mean, I wouldn't be doing it otherwise. You know, and I'm a realist. I think it's obviously it's going to be very difficult. I think obviously the Penske cars seem very well prepared. The Ganassi cars are very well prepared, and Michael's team always features very strongly at the Indianapolis 500. I think particularly Marco. So you know, it will be very, very difficult. There's no doubt about that. But I absolutely think that we've got a shot. The last 2 years, we've been able to kind of mix it with both the Penske's and Ganassi's. I think in 2009, obviously, we were only beaten by one Penske, and it was a Ganassi car last year. So there's certainly the capability to do that. Like I said, I'm a realist and can understand that it's going to be very difficult. But you know, that's never to say it's impossible. And you know, the William Rass guys and the Curb Records, Big Machine Records car will be. I think it's going to be very well put together. It's you know, there's a lot of detail that's gone into putting it together. I think with the fact that we haven't been competing in the full season, that's given the guys a little bit more time to prepare. But you know, I do think if we do everything right, we certainly have that opportunity to be able to win.
Well, last year, Dan, during qualifications, Brian Herta quipped that he was going to take his name off the door and just call it the two men in a truck racing team. What changes have gone on at that team since last year that we may see this year?
Well, I think Brian was you know, it was his first year at the Speedway as an owner, and I think he had different goals back then. It was about, you know, kind of getting into the race and just gaining experience. Obviously, he had Sebastian Cervejo driving for him at that time, and he was very new to the Indy cars, and he was obviously a rookie at the Speedway. But when you look at the job that he did in the race, I think obviously it was very close for him being able to qualify, but. You know, so once he was in the race, he seemed certainly reasonable. But I think Brian is in a situation now where he's certainly kind of upped his game. You know, I think there's a lot more preparation that's gone into the race car. The attention to detail, which makes a huge difference at Indianapolis, it seems to be a lot better from what I understand. And it's a situation where Brian's aligned himself with another team that featured very strongly there last year. So it's, you know, I think very important for him to do well. He obviously wants to deliver, like I've talked about, for William Rast and Curb Records and Big Machine Records and Forsyth. So it's, you know, it's important from that standpoint. And when there is that importance, and I think he knows that I have that hunger to win and I'm capable to win, He's really kind of, you know, elevated the professionalism of the team to be able to compete like this.
In that same vein, can you let us in a little bit on who some of the key people are in the team? Do you have your strategist and your engineer and, you know, those types of team members lined up yet?
Well, I think obviously Brian Herter and Steve Newey are the people, along with Todd Malloy and Brian Page, that are going to, you know, be the most influential in terms of strategy and stuff. When it comes to the race, it's I have to say this, that this, and this is what racing is all about. It looks very individualistic with just myself in the race car, but it takes everybody. Brian's put a very, very strong group together, and I think all will be as important as one another. I don't think there's any one of us that will stand out that's more important than the other, but certainly from a strategic standpoint, Brian Herder and Steve Newey are kind of the key players, and then my engineer will be Todd Malloy, who will be working with Brian Page as the assistant. So there's obviously a lot of good people involved, and it's just a case of, like I say, really, really utilizing the track time that you have. It can get interrupted by weather here and there, but we need to make use of the track time and prepare as best we can for the race and not get kind of too involved in the qualifying.
Now, Dan, obviously you mentioned that you've been sitting on the sidelines for the season thus far. You've mentioned in a couple of venues, though, that you haven't found that as frustrating as people might think. Can you talk a little bit about how you've been feeling with watching events unfold around you?
Well, I have to say, watching them is not particularly nice. I'm not going to lie to you on that one. And it was funny, actually, because, you know, in the off-season, I know it looks easy for drivers, but... you know, you certainly after the last race, you always get a little bit of a break. But then, you know, pretty much after that, and particularly the last few years with the economy being so tough, you know, it's important for the race teams to, you know, justify the expenditure to the sponsors. And that might involve more appearances, and obviously it involves performance. You've got to make sure you're performing. So you know, as long as I've been racing, that you've never, although you've had long off seasons, You've never had an off season, or I've never had an off season where I've not been contracted to a team. So it's, you know, there's always that constant communication, and I like that. I like that aspect of it, and I like to be constantly challenging the engineers and the people within the team, as do they me. But you know, it's my wife and I had just had our second baby, so we were certainly busy with that. You know, it was certainly nice to spend some time just, you know, at that point with my wife and my first son. You know, then we went back to Europe to visit my family. So that was, I mean, that was, you know, very nice. Then it got to the point where, you know, that first race was coming up, and although we were able to announce that I was going to be driving for Brian in the 500, you know, it was still very difficult to be at the track, and but I will say not so bad, because you know, there was some announcement stuff going on, but then I went to Long Beach, which was very nice, because I met all the people from William Rast and Curb Records, but at that point, I mean, we were announcing the paint scheme of the race car and the sponsors, but it really started to, you know, make your blood boil when you're watching the cars go around. You really want to be part of that. And, you know, I think, like I say, I've been involved for so long in IndyCars that, you know, I think to some degree, it just that feeling, you just get so used to it being part of it. And, you know, having had some of this time off, it's really made me realize how much I love the sport and how much I, you know, miss not being, you know, part of it weekend in, weekend out. So it's I'm going to certainly be real hungry when I jump in that race car come May. I actually joked with Brian the other day when I got off the phone to him. I said, listen, it's going to be like you're going to have to control a kid to start with, because that's how I'm going to be. But I don't think anybody can ever say that I've never had enough of enthusiasm for the sport, because I just love it. But I'm really concerned about how I'm going to be when I get in the race car on opening day at the Speedway.
And you mentioned the birth of your son, and we wanted to congratulate you on that as well. So, yeah, that's wonderful news. Glad to hear everyone's doing well. At the Long Beach announcement, you and Brian sort of alluded to the fact that there might be future races in store for later in this season. Has there been any development on that?
I think Brian alluded to that. And he's the boss, and he's the one with the checkbook. So,
right.
Yeah, I'm certainly very hopeful, you know, of that to be the case. But with the situation that I'm in right now, and I think, like I said, I've been around long enough to understand how the business works. I only have a contract for Indianapolis right now, and so we'll just have to wait and see as to any future developments. There's always a lot of talk in racing, but you know, as they say, talk is cheap. So we'll have to wait and see. You know, certainly I think that Brian is looking to be a full-time team in 2012. So this is kind of a, you know, a great start up to what could happen. But by the same token, there's a lot of work to do. But with Brian's team right now, having William Raft on board, Curb Records, Big Machine Records, and Foresight Solutions, we've got a great group of sponsors. I think, you know, certainly being a bit of a fashionista, William Raft fits very well with me, so I'm excited about that. I'll definitely be the best dressed at the Speedway. But it's, you know, it's exciting times, but I don't want to get ahead of ourselves. And, you know, we've got a lot of work to do this May, and that's what we're focused on. So if we can do a very good job in May, which I'm sure we can, and, you know, if we could pull off a win, I think that would definitely help cement a lot of these deals moving forward.
Well, Dan, you mentioned 2012, and you also mentioned that there's a lot of talk in racing, and so those two items come together for our next question. There's been some discussion that the IndyCar Series and Tony Kottman and the group developing the car for next year are looking for a driver who doesn't currently have a deal to do the testing, and your name has been tossed around as one of the people that they might be looking at to do that. Are you able to tell us anything about whether that's been the case?
You know, like I say, I don't have any signed contracts right now, so you know, I'd certainly be open to discussing that possibility. But you know, I think right now my sole focus is on the Indianapolis 500. Like I say, when I was on the phone to Brian, Brian, really, you're gonna have to calm me down. So he was chuckling.
Have you asked Brian if you can just drive the car to the track?
Yeah, he knows me well enough to know that we were just talking about what the plan was for running, and he's like, well, I think we want to do is we're gonna do an installation run on opening day. We're gonna bring the car back, and then we're gonna let you go out and do one kind of 4 or 5 lap run. I said, Brian, after 4 months out of the race car, you've got to let me do more than that. So yeah, we'll see.
We'll look forward to it.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Dan. Really appreciate it.
And our thanks to Dan Weldon and also to Robin Miller for joining us in our podcast this evening. And thanks to all of you for listening as well. Please remember to keep an eye on More Front Wing throughout the month of May as we roll out our centennial celebrations, including our centennial interview series, centennial featured team member profiles, and much more as we highlight the centennial running of the Indianapolis 500. And remember that morefrontwing.com is your source online for blogs, photos, podcasts, and more covering the IZOD IndyCar Series and beyond.